sponsors want you to walk away from a lifetime's work. When I first joined United, there was a group of supporters known as the Second Board. They would meet in the grill room and decide what they thought was wrong with Manchester United. Back then, when my position was more fragile, I was more attuned to the damage that might be done to my position should they turn against me. Other United managers before me had felt the same way. In my playing days at Rangers, a group of powerful fans travelled with the first team and were influential lobbyists. At United, there was a larger array of supporters' voices. In disgust at the Glazer takeover, some handed in their season tickets and started FC United of Manchester. There is a price to pay when you support a football club. And the price is, you can't win every game. You're not going to be a manager for a lifetime. United are lucky to have had two for half a century. With losing and winning games, the emotions rise and fall. Football naturally generates dissent. I remember us losing a game at Rangers and the supporters throwing bricks through the windows. There was no reason beyond my age for the Glazers to consider a change of manager in the summer of 2005. I never considered that possibility, never felt under threat. The tens of millions of pounds paid out in interest to service the loans did arouse protective feelings towards the club. I understood that, but at no stage did it translate into pressure to sell a player or excessive caution on the purchasing front. One of their strengths was their commercial department in London, which brought in dozens of sponsorships globally. We had Turkish Airlines, telephone companies in Saudi Arabia, Hong Kong, Thailand, beer companies in the Far East. That sucked in tens of millions and helped service the debt. On the football side, we generated huge earnings. The 76,000 crowds helped a great deal. So, at no stage was I held back by the Glazer ownership. Often we would lose interest in a player because the transfer fee or wage demands had become silly. Those decisions were taken by me and David Gill. There was no edict from above to spend only in line with the club's debt. Instead, our galaxy went on expanding. From 2007, more foreign talent poured into Carrington from South America, Portugal and Bulgaria. No imported player in those years attracted more attention than Carlos Tevez, who was at the heart of a major controversy over the relegation of Sheffield United from the Premier League and was to end up in opposition to us at Manchester City, staring down from that provocative billboard in his sky-blue shirt underneath the message, "Welcome to Manchester." The tale begins when Tevez was at West Ham and David Gill was receiving calls from his agent, Kia Jurabkin, saying the boy would love to play for Man United. We had heard that kind of story many times. It was almost routine for agents to call saying their client had a special feeling for our crest. My advice was that we should not involve ourselves in any complicated dealings with the Tevez camp. David agreed. It was clear that a consortium of people owned the player. But to David, I also remarked, "He does make an impact in games with his energy, and he has a decent scoring record." It would depend what the deal was. David told me he could acquire Tevez on loan for 2 years for a fee. That was the way it turned out, and Carlos did well for us in his first season. He scored a lot of important goals against Lyon, Blackburn, Tottenham and Chelsea. There was a real enthusiasm and energy about him. He wasn't blessed with great pace and wasn't a great trainer. He would always like a wee break, saying his calf was sore. In the context of the way we prepared, that sometimes annoyed us. We wanted to see a genuine desire to train all the time. Top players have that. But Tevez compensated quite well with his enthusiasm in games. In the 2008 European Cup final in Moscow, he played and scored in the penalty shootout against Chelsea. He was our first taker. In the game itself, I took Rooney off and left Tevez on because he was playing better than Wayne. What planted a doubt in my mind was that in his second season, I signed Dimitar Berbatov, and the emphasis was on Berbatov and Rooney as our forward partnership. Watching Dimitar at Tottenham, I felt he would make a difference because he had a certain composure and awareness that we lacked among our group of strikers. He displayed the ability of Cantona or Teddy Sheringham. Not lightning quick, but he could lift his head and make a creative pass. I thought he could bring us up a level and extend our range of talents. So Berbatov's arrival relegated Tevez to more of a backup role. And around December in his second season, we started to feel he wasn't doing especially well. The reason, I think, was that he's the type of animal that needs to play all the time. If you're not training intensively, which he wasn't, you need to play regularly. During that winter, David Gill asked, "What do you want to do?" I felt we ought to wait until later in the season to make a decision. "They want one now," David said. I replied, "Just tell them I'm trying to get him more games so we can assess it properly, because Berbatov is in the team a lot." Tevez did influence plenty of outcomes in the second half of the 2008-2009 campaign, especially against Spurs at home when we were 2-0 down and I sent him on to shake things up. He chased absolutely everything. He brought huge enthusiasm to the cause and was the one responsible for us winning that match 5-2. His impact changed the course of events. The 2009 Champions League semi-final pitted us against Arsenal, and I was playing a three of Ronaldo, Rooney and Park. That was my chosen group for the final, and apparently Tevez was not impressed. We made a mess of the final in Rome against Barcelona, which was a bad to tell. It was a shambles. We have to hold our hands up about our poor planning. Anyway, I brought Tevez on at half-time and just felt he was playing for himself a bit. From what I could gather, he had already made his mind up before joining City. After the game in Rome, he said to me, "You never showed any great desire to sign me permanently." I explained that I had to see how the season played out and that he hadn't played enough games for me to be sure. David offered the $25 million fee for him, but from what I can gather, it was as if he were talking to the wall. That led us to think he had already elected to move across town. The rumour, not confirmed, was that our Manchester rivals had paid $47 million. Tevez spoke to Chelsea at some point too, and I think his advisers played one against the other. The word was that Chelsea offered $35 million, but that City outbid them. To me, these were incredible sums. I wouldn't have paid that kind of money. Fine player, though he was. To me, he was an impact maker. It was a mistake on my part, in the sense that Berbatov was a player I fancied strongly and I wanted to see him succeed. But he is also the sort who wants to be assured he is a great player. The conundrum with him and Tevez was always there. There was no disciplinary problem with Tevez of the sort Roberto Mancini encountered when the boy declined to warm up for City, apparently in a Champions League game in Germany. But there was a major hoo-ha over his supposed role in Sheffield United's demotion to the Championship in 2007. Tevez's goals had been saving West Ham from relegation when they came to our ground at the end of that season. They were fined for breaching third-party ownership rules with Tevez, but no points were deducted by the Premier League. Inevitably, Tevez scored against us for West Ham, which helped send Sheffield United down, and Neil Warnock, their manager, tried to load the blame on us for playing a supposedly weakened team against the Hammers. We had a cup final the week after that West Ham game. Our squad was one of the strongest in the league, and I had been changing the team all season according to circumstance. If you watch that match, we had two or three penalties turned down, and their goalkeeper had a fantastic game. They broke away and Tevez scored. West Ham were never in the game. We battered them. I brought on Ronaldo, Rooney and Giggs in the second half, but we still couldn't knock them over. Meanwhile, Mr. Warnock accuses us of throwing the game away. In their last game, they faced Wigan at home, and all they needed was a draw. In early January, Warnock had to let David Unsworth go on a free transfer to Wigan, and Unsworth takes the penalty kick that knocks Sheffield United out of the Premier League. Could anyone with an open mind not say, "I made a mess of that there"? Has he ever looked at himself in the mirror and said, "All we needed was a draw at home, and we weren't good enough to take a point off Wigan"? The accusation was ridiculous. In January 2007, we acquired a real aristocrat, for a two-month spell at any rate. Louis Saha had returned at the start of the season, full of promise, but picked up another injury. In October, Jim Lawler, United's chief scout, pointed out to us that it was a waste for Henrik Larsson to be playing in Sweden when he still had so much to offer on a bigger stage. Helsingborg's, where Henrik was playing, would not sell him, but I asked Jim to ask their chairman what they would think about him coming on loan in January. Henrik pushed the boat in that direction with his employers. On arrival at United, he seemed a bit of a cult figure with our players. They would say his name in odd tones. For a man of 35 years of age, his receptiveness to information on the coaching side was amazing. At every session, he was rapt, He wanted to listen to Carlos, the tactics lectures. He was into every nuance of what we did. In training, he was superb. His movement, his positional play. His 3 goals for us were no measure of his contribution. In his last game in our colours at Middlesbrough, we were losing 2-1, and Henrik went back to play in midfield and ran his balls off. On his return to the dressing room, all the players stood up and applauded him, and the staff joined in. It takes some player to make that kind of impact in 2 months. Cult status can vanish in 2 minutes if a player isn't doing his job. Yet Henrik retained that aura in his time with us. He looked a natural Man United player with his movement and courage. He also had a great spring for a little lad. I could have signed him earlier. I was ready to make the bid when he was at Celtic, but Dermot Desmond, Celtic's majority shareholder, rang me and said,
"You've let me down, Alex. You've got tons of players. We need them."
A month after Henrik went back to Sweden, we registered one of our greatest European victories. The 7-1 win over Roma on the 10th of April. Our highest Champions League score. There were 2 goals each for Michael Carrick and Ronaldo, 1 from Rooney, Alan Smith, and even Patrice Evra, who scored for the first time in Europe. Top games of football are generally won by 8 players. 3 players can be carried if they're having an off night and work their socks off, or are playing a purely tactical role for the team in order to secure the result. But half a dozen times in your career, you achieve perfection, where all 11 are on song. Everything we did that night came off. For the 2nd goal, we produced a 6-man move of one-touch passing. Alan Smith scored from a Ryan Giggs pass between the 2 centre-backs. First time, bang, in the net. Brilliant goal. So you have these moments when you say, we could not have improved on that. I remember taking a team to Nottingham Forest in 1999 and winning 8-1. It could have been 20. Roma were a bloody good side too. They had Daniele De Rossi, Christian Kivu and Francesco Totti, and we absolutely slaughtered them. We had been beaten 2-1 in Rome, where Scholes had been sent off for a suicidal tackle right on the touchline. The boy was practically off the pitch when Paul arrived with his challenge. So we were under some pressure in the return leg, until the goals started flying in. Wimbledon away in the FA Cup in February 1994 was another classic. In a 3-0 win, we scored 1 goal with 38 passes. People talk of the best Man United goal being Ryan Giggs's in that FA Cup semi-final against Arsenal, or Rooney's overhead kick against Manchester City. But for me, that goal at Wimbledon was sublime. Every player in the team touched the ball. In the first minute of the game, Vinnie Jones tried to do Cantona. Crack! Down went Eric. All our players ran towards Jones, but Cantona said, "Leave him alone," because he was a fellow ex-Leeds player, and may have felt a kinship. Then he patted Jones on the back as if to say, "You can kick me if you like, but you won't stop me." Cantona was marvellous that day, and scored our first goal with a beautiful volley that he teed up for himself with his right foot. People always said Wimbledon couldn't play. That's not true. The quality of the service to their front players was high, especially the crosses. Their set-piece delivery was terrific. They were not devoid of talent. What they did was use those talents as a weapon against weaker people. If you didn't head the ball, you were dead. If you couldn't handle set-pieces, you were dead. If you wanted to get into a 50-50 with them, no chance. They were hard to play against, so that 3-0 win in their ground was special to us. 2 big wins over Arsenal also stand out. In a 6-2 win at Highbury in the League Cup in 1990, Lee Sharp scored a hat-trick. On another occasion in February 2001, we beat them 6-1 at Old Trafford. An Irish family had bought an auction prize to see us play at Liverpool in December 2000, but we were fog-bound and unable to travel. We lost 1-0 to Liverpool in a horrible game. They rang me and asked,
"What are we going to do?"
I told them, "We've got Arsenal at home soon." And they saw a 6-1 massacre. What a difference. It was 5-1 at half-time. Yorkie tore them apart. Despite our 7-1 win over Roma, our Champions League campaign was ended by a 3-0 defeat in Milan on the 2nd of May. We had been forced to field a full team on the previous Saturday in order to beat Everton 4-2 at Goodison Park, while Milan had rested 9 players for their game against us, which was on the Tuesday. We were simply not as well prepared as our Italian opponents. We conceded twice in 15 minutes, it bucketed with rain, and we just couldn't break out of our own half. We simply weren't ready for it. Winning on the Saturday had been a mammoth task because we had been 2-0 down against Everton, yet we won the game to move 5 points clear in the league. Along with Tevez and Larsson, other global talents joined us. Carlos, through his Portuguese connections, told us there was a young boy at Porto from Brazil called Anderson. He was 16 or 17. We kept an eye on him. He was in and out of the team. A game here, an appearance from the bench there. Then he played against us in the Amsterdam tournament, and I resolved to act. But the following week, he broke his leg. When his recovery was complete, I sent Martin over to watch him in every game for 4 or 5 weeks. Martin said, "Alex, he's better than Rooney." "Oh, for Christ's sakes, don't say that," I told him. "He'll need to be good to be better than Rooney." Martin was adamant. At that stage, Anderson was playing off the striker. At the end of the tournament, we moved to buy both him and Nani, who I went to see for myself. What attracted me to Nani was his pace, strength and aerial ability. He had 2 fine feet. All the individual attributes were there, which brought us round to the old question. What type of boy was he? Answer? A good one. Quiet. Could speak English reasonably well. Never caused any problems at Sporting Lisbon. And was an excellent trainer. My word. He's a fit boy. Gymnastic, too. His athletic readouts were always first class. So the foundations were there. Carlos went over with David Gill, called into Sporting Lisbon to sign Nani, and then drove up to Porto to capture Anderson. All in one day. 2 years on, we were able to say that the reasons for signing them were correct. There were no complications with Anderson in the winter of 2009-2010. He wasn't playing as much as he would have liked to, and wanted to return home. He was Brazilian, and the complication, as ever, was the World Cup, which he was desperate to play in. His scheme was to go to Vasco da Gama for the rest of the season so he could play in the South Africa World Cup of 2010. "You're not leaving here. We're not investing millions of pounds in a player so he can shoot off to Brazil," I told him. Lovely personality, Anderson. I've always respected Brazilian footballers. Name a Brazilian player who doesn't excel in big games. They were born for the big occasion. They have a special quality, deep pride in themselves, great belief. There is a myth that Brazilians regard training as an onerous interruption to a life of pleasure. Not true. They train conscientiously. The notion that they hate the cold is another fallacy. The two Da Silva brothers, for example, no tracksuit bottoms, no gloves, out they go. No country can apply the rich mix of ingredients you gain from a top Brazilian player. Argentines are deeply patriotic, but I found they lack the expressive personalities of Brazilians. With Nani, we were buying pure raw material. He was immature, inconsistent, but with a wonderful instinct for football. He could control the ball with either foot, head the ball, and he bristled with physical strength. He could cross, shoot. When you buy a player with all those talents, the trick is to put them in order. He was a bit disorganised and needed to be more consistent. It was inevitable that he would work in Ronaldo's shadow because he was a winger from Portugal with some of the same attributes. Had he been from Serbia, no one would have made the comparison. But both Ronaldo and Nani had come through Sporting Lisbon, so they were always being studied side by side. Ronaldo was blessed with outrageous talent, and he was brave, with 2 great feet and a wonderful leap. It was perhaps daunting for Nani to assert himself as a Man United starter against that backdrop. To be up against Ronaldo in team selection was a problem in itself. In his first year, he was on the bench a lot. Nani picked up the language quickly, but Anderson took longer. Because he's Brazilian, though, he brought incredible self-belief to the job. Brazilians think they can play against anybody. I would say to Anderson, "Have you seen this Neymar in Brazil?" "Oh, great player, fantastic. Have you seen Robinho?" "Wonderful, incredible player." Every Brazilian name I mentioned would elicit this response. He thought everyone back home was world class. When Brazil battered Portugal in a friendly, Anderson told Ronaldo, "Next time we'll play our fifth team to give you a chance. Ronaldo was not amused. That's the kind of country Brazil is. I love that story about the competition in Rio to unearth new number 10s and thousands turning up. One boy travelled for 22 hours in a bus. It's a massive country with talent everywhere. I look back less fondly on our move for Owen Hargreaves, who was phenomenal in the summer of 2006 and was just the type of player we needed to fill the gap left by Keane. We started to put together a bid for him, but I studied his playing record and felt a tinge of doubt. I didn't feel a strong vibe about him. David Gill worked hard on the deal with Bayern. I met Owen's agent at the World Cup final in Berlin. Nice man, a lawyer. I told him we could develop Hargreaves at United. Turned out to be a disaster. Owen had no confidence in himself whatsoever. He didn't show nearly enough determination to overcome his physical difficulties for my liking. I saw him opt for the easy choice too often in terms of training. He was one of the most disappointing signings of my career. He went everywhere in search of cures for his various injuries. Germany, America, Canada. I felt he lacked the confidence to overcome his injuries. It went from bad to worse. He was away in America for the best part of a year. He saw Hans Müller-Volfart, the club doctor at Bayern Munich, for his calf. In the games he did actually play, I had no qualms about his contribution. He was lightning quick and a great set-piece deliverer. He could play right back, wide right or central midfield. I played him wide right in the 2008 final against Chelsea. And when we started to struggle against their midfield three, I put him in the middle of the park with Rooney wide right, and it worked. He had definite value, but it was all lost in the fog of his lack of games. Yet Hargreaves was fantastic for England in the 2006 World Cup, plugging gaps, racing to the ball. In September 2011, we took a blast from Hargreaves about how he had been supposedly let down by our medical staff in his time with us. He claimed we had used him like a guinea pig for treatments for his tendonitis and various knee problems. We took legal advice and could have proceeded against him, but the doctor was not sufficiently offended to seek legal redress. We did the best for that lad. No matter what the staff did for him, he created his own agenda. I would say to him, "How are you this morning?" "Great, boss," he would reply, "but I think I'll do something on my own. I'm feeling it a bit." One of his allegations was that we picked him for the Wolves game in early November 2010 when he had asked not to be selected. Rubbish. 3 weeks before that fixture, he had advised us that he would be ready for such and such a date, which happened to be a European tie. I was reluctant to bring him back in a European game after he'd been out for so long. There was a reserve game that week, which he was meant to play in, but he withdrew. In the week of the Wolves game, to my knowledge, he said nothing to our staff to indicate he had a problem. My concern, which I expressed to Mick Phelan, was that he would pick up an injury in the warm-up. My understanding was that he told one of the players he was feeling his hamstring a bit. When he came in from the warm-up, I specifically asked him, "You all right?" I said it to reassure him. My message was, "Enjoy it." Well, it lasted 5 minutes. His hamstring went, but it was no surprise. When I signed him, there was something about him I didn't like. The thing every good leader should have is an instinct. Mine said to me, "I don't fancy this." When he came over to Old Trafford for the medical, I still had some indefinable doubt. He was very hail fellow well met, almost too nice. Cleverson also left me with doubts, but only because he was so timid and could barely look you in the eye. He had good ability, Cleverson. He paid too much attention to what his father-in-law and wife wanted. I read later that the FA were going to fast-track Hargreaves into coaching. That's one of the things that's wrong with our game. That wouldn't happen in France or Germany or Holland, where you would spend 3 years earning your stripes. Bebe is the only player I ever signed without first seeing him in action. We have a good scout in Portugal who had flagged him up. This boy had been playing homeless football and became a trialist for a second division team. He did really well. Our scout told us, "We need to watch him." Then Real Madrid were on his tail. I know that's true because Jose Mourinho told me that Real were ready to sign him, and that United had jumped in front of them. We took a wee gamble on it, for about €7 million. Bebe came with limitations, but there was a talent there. He had fantastic feet. He struck the ball with venom, off either foot, with no drawback. He was not the complete player, but we were coaching him to be better. We farmed him out to Turkey, and he injured his cruciate knee ligament after 2 weeks. We brought him home and put him on remedial work, then in the reserves. He did all right. He trained well in the short games, 8v8, goal to goal. On the big pitch, his concept of team play needed work. With feet like his, he was capable of scoring 20 goals a season. He was a quiet boy, spoke reasonable English, and had, obviously, had a hard upbringing, wandering the streets of Lisbon. With so many players coming in, I was proud of the work we did on those who were to end up with other clubs. In the spring of 2010, for instance, there were 72 players throughout Scotland, Europe and England who had been through an apprenticeship at Man United. 72. Fabio Capello told a good friend of mine that if you put gowns and masks on Man United players, you could spot them a mile away, which was quite a compliment. Their behaviour and training stand out. We had 3 in Denmark, 1 in Germany, 2 in Belgium, and others all over the place in England. We had 7 goalkeepers out there, none of whom had made the first team. Kevin Pilkington, Michael Pollitt, Ben Williams and Luke Steele among them. We were adept at identifying the players who would become first-team regulars. There is something visible in a top-grade Manchester United player that forces you to promote him to the first team. Darren Gibson was an example of one who brings you to that crossroads, where a decision needs to be made about whether he is going to be a first-team player. In 2009-2010, he was at the stage where we were in danger of not being fair to him. He had different qualities to most of my other midfielders. His main attribute was that he could score from outside the box. Scholes was the only other player who could do that, but he was coming to the end. So, the judgment was a tough one, as it was with Tom Cleverley, who was at Watford, where he had scored 11 times from midfield. Cleverley had no physique, was wiry as hell, but he was as brave as a lion, had good feet and could score a goal. David Gill said one day, "What are you going to do with Cleverley next year? Scoring a lot of goals at Watford." My answer was, "I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to play him, to find out whether he can score goals for me as well as Watford." Could he score 6 for me? Nobody else was getting half a dozen from midfield. Michael Carrick had struck a high note of 5. If Cleverley could score 6 goals in the Premier League from midfield, he would become a consideration. The demarcation line was always, what can they do and what can they not do? The can-do question was, can they win me the game? If they could score 6 goals, I could ignore some of the negatives. At 20 or 21, players would sometimes stagnate. If they were not in the first team by then, they could become disheartened. I reached that moment in my own playing career. At 21, I was fed up at St Johnstone and took papers out to emigrate to Canada. I was disillusioned. Football's not for me, I was saying. I'm not getting anywhere. At the United reserve level, we encountered this dilemma all the time. We would send players out on loan in the hope they would come back better, but often sent them to a level that would suit them more in the long term anyway, so they could find careers. We were proud to have relocated the 72 players I talked about elsewhere in the game. The ones who make it have a way of telling you their certainties to reach the grade. Welbeck is an example. At one point I tipped him to make Fabio Capello's 2010 World Cup squad, but he had issues to do with the pace he was growing at. At 19, he was still shooting up and encountering problems with his knees. I told him to go carefully in training sessions and save his best for matches. He was on course to end up 6'2" or 6'3" tall. But what a good player. Such a confident boy. I said to him, "One of these days, I'm going to kill you." Because he was such a cocky so-and-so, and he replied, "I'll probably deserve it." Touché. He had an answer for everything. A constant in our discussions about young players was whether they could handle the demands of the Old Trafford crowd and the short patience span of the media. Would they grow or shrink in a United shirt? We knew the make-up of every young, homegrown player who came into the United starting 11 from the training ground, from reserve team football. By the time a player graduated from youth or reserve team football, we aimed to be sure about their temperaments, sure about their characters, and sure of their abilities. But, plainly, when we bought players in from abroad, we knew less about them, however hard we investigated their backgrounds, and the peculiar swirl of playing for United could undo some of these imported names. In 2009-2010, We were researching Javier Hernandez, nicknamed Chicharito. It means little pea. He was 21 years of age. We sent a scout out to live in Mexico for a month. The information we received was that he was a family boy who was reluctant to leave Mexico. Our contact out there helped us research his background down to every detail. United support is odd in some respects. We would sign a player for $2 million, and some fans would consider it a sign of weakness and believe we had lowered our standards. Gabriel Obertan was in that price range. He was greased lightning. But in the final third of the field, his feet were sometimes all over the place. His task was to coordinate his speed with his brain and deliver the hurt in the final third of the pitch. Mame Biram Diouf was recommended by Ole Gunnar Solskjaer through his contacts at Molde in Norway. Hanover 96 and Eintracht Frankfurt were starting to sniff around him when we stepped up our interest. So we sent Ole and a club official over and acquired him for €4 million. Again, the background was right, though he never established himself with us. Chris Smalling was bought from Fulham in January 2010, with the idea that he would join us for the start of the 2010-2011 campaign. He had been playing with non-league Maidstone until 2008, but Roy Hodgson developed a high regard for him at Fulham. He cost us around $10 million. We moved for him when Rio Ferdinand started having problems with his back and other parts. We were on to centre-backs everywhere, all over. We watched them all through 2009-2010, and thought Smalling was a young guy who would mature into his frame. Long term, I could imagine a central defence forming around Chris Smalling and Johnny Evans. There was no resting on the status quo, even in the best times. The longer I stayed, the further I looked ahead. Regeneration was an everyday duty. 17. One night in Moscow. Before the Moscow Champions League final of 2008, I was the reluctant holder of possibly the worst record in penalty shootouts. I had lost two semi-finals at Aberdeen, a European tie at Aberdeen, an FA Cup tie at Old Trafford against Southampton, an FA Cup final against Arsenal, and a European tie in Moscow through penalty shootouts. Six defeats and one victory was the inauspicious context to Carlos Tevez placing the ball on the spot at the start of our shootout with Chelsea in Roman Abramovich's hometown. With those memories, you would hardly expect me to have been optimistic. All those earlier disappointments were in my head as the game stretched beyond extra time and the match crept into the early hours of the following day after a 10:45 p.m. kickoff. When Van der Sar saved from Nicholas and Elka to win the trophy for us, I hardly made it off my seat, because I could barely believe we had won. I stayed motionless for several moments. Ronaldo was lying in the turf crying because he had missed his penalty kick. Our goalkeeping coach had compiled all the video analysis we could possibly need and was able to pull the data up on a screen to show Van der Sar how each Chelsea player might take his spot kick. For several days, we had discussed the order in which our players would step up. They were all good, apart from Ronaldo, who had been scoring them all season. Giggs's execution was the best. Hard and low, inside the post. Hargreaves battered his into the top corner. Nani was a touch lucky because the goalkeeper should have saved it and got a hand to it. Carrick's was straightforward. Ronaldo hesitated and stopped. John Terry had only to knock his in to win the game for Chelsea. At that point, I was still and calm, thinking, what am I going to say to the players? I knew I would have to be careful with my words in defeat. It would be unfair to slaughter them after a European final, I told myself, because they had worked so hard to get there. And these are deeply emotional moments for those in the thick of the action. When Terry missed the 10th penalty in the sequence, and we headed into sudden death, my optimism returned. Anderson's penalty, the first in the do-or-die stage, had lifted our supporters, because he had run to them to celebrate. And they were then buoyant again. The kicks were taken into our end of the ground, which was an advantage. In no sense was this a conventional European final. The time zone was the first quirk, which meant the game had kicked off at 10:45 p.m. I always remember, too, that the rain had drenched me and ruined my shoes, so I attended the victory party in trainers, for which I took plenty of stick from the players. I knew I should have packed a spare pair of shoes. It was between 4 and 5 a.m. by the time we sat down for the buffet. The food was poor, but the players gave Giggs a wonderful gift to commemorate him passing Bobby Charlton's appearance record. This was his 759th game. On the stage, they all sang his name. The game itself was a marvellous drama which drew some terrific performances from our side. I thought Wes Brown had one of his best games for United and set up Ronaldo's opening goal with an excellent cross. In Chelsea's semi-final, Mikel Essien had played right back, and I decided while watching Avram Grant's team that Ronaldo would play wide left to make life uncomfortable for Essien, a midfielder by trade. For our goal, Ronaldo outjumped Essien, so the plan worked. A midfielder playing right back against an attacker of Ronaldo's brilliance was a big ask, and our man tore him apart. Moving Ronaldo left opened the door for someone to play wide right. I chose Hargreaves, who was quick, had energy, and could cross the ball. He did well in that role. In the centre of midfield, we had Scholes and Carrick, though Scholes was to come off with a bleeding nose. His breathing was starting to become congested. Giggs went on in his place and prospered. Despite the culture shock of Moscow and the hotel, our preparation had been smooth. In the semi-finals, we had beaten Barcelona, drawing 0-0 over there and winning by a single goal at our place. Scholes's goal was magnificent, a typical thunderbolt from 25 yards. In the first 20 minutes at Camp Nou, we played well, as we often did against them, striking the bar and missing a penalty. When they took a grip in the game, we just retreated towards the box, which we might have done again in the 2009 and 2011 finals, had I not been determined to win those games our way. You could call that tactically naive if you wish, but I disagree. We were trying to strengthen our philosophy about winning in the right manner. My thought on the two semi-finals was that we endured a lot of heart-stopping moments. We lived on the edge of the box or inside it, desperate to escape. At Old Trafford, in an even game, we ought to have won by more, with our good counter-attacking. Equally, when they brought on Thierry Henry for the last 15 minutes, they besieged us in our penalty box. It was agony on the touchline, looking at my watch. Later, I called it the greatest example of the fans getting behind our men. Every clearance from our box raised a cheer, unusually. Henri missed a sitter. We showed great character. The team absorbed immense pressure and maintained their concentration. After the game, I also said, "They can't be shrinking violets here. They have to be men." And they were men that night. We always fancied our chances of adding to the European Cups of 1968 and 1999, provided we could take control of the ball quickly in Moscow, which we did from the start. Our game was full of thrust and invention, and we might have been 3 or 4 goals up. I started to think it would be a massacre. Goals can turn games upside down, however, and Chelsea enjoyed a dash of luck just before half-time, equalising through Frank Lampard, which set us on the back foot. Chelsea progressed from there and were the better side for 25 minutes of the second half. Drogba struck a post. That was my signal to think fast about how we might regain a hold on the game. I sent Rooney wide right and brought Hargreaves into a more central position, which put us on top in the game again. By the end, I felt we were the superior group of players. Caught in the ebb and flow of events at pitch level, you can never be quite sure whether the spectacle in front of you is entertaining. But everyone felt this was a terrific piece of theatre, one of the best European Cup finals. It was satisfying to be part of a show that displayed our league in such a good light. I must give credit to Edwin van der Sar for the intelligence of his shot-stopping. As Anelka jogged towards the penalty spot, I was thinking, "Dive to your left." On the previous two kicks, one driven wide by Terry and the other converted by Kalu, Edwin had dived to the right. So when Anelka approached his moment of truth, he was probably asking himself, "I wonder whether he's going to dive to his right or his left." Yes, Anelka's penalty was poor, but Edwin chose the correct way to dive. To his right. Avram Grant is a nice man. My fear was always he might not be strong enough for that group of Chelsea players. Their behaviour in the final was terrible, dragging themselves out for the second half one at a time, giving the referee stick on the way into the dressing room. A team goes out together. They don't amble out one by one. The referee had been urging them to get a move on, but they just ignored him. At the interval, they tried every trick in the book. That might have played in the referee's mind when Drogba was sent off. The red card for Drogba followed a clash with Carlos Tevez, which brought Vidic over to support his teammate. Up went Drogba's hand to flick Vida's face. If you lift your hands, you've no chance. My understanding was that the referee asked the linesman who the offender had been, and boomf, Drogba was off. By then, we had already restored our hold in the game. Drogba's dismissal was not the turning point. Giggs had a shot cleared off the line. We created chances in extra time and should have killed them off. Chelsea, in my view, played for the draw and gambled on winning the shootout. Though he was removed from the fray that night, Drogba was always a handful for us. He was a powerful, big lad, but what marked him out in my book was a talent for spectacular goals, say on the turn from 30 yards. I was surprised to see him missing from the team sheet against us in a game during Carlo Ancelotti's final weeks in charge. Torres started, but Drogba came on to score and forced Chelsea back into the match. From that Chelsea team, which we found it difficult to play against, the goalkeeper, Petr Cech, was outstanding. I should have signed him at 19 when I had my chance. Instead, Chelsea took him that summer for £8 million. John Terry was always an influence in their team. Ashley Cole always gave them energy going forward. And Frank Lampard was incredibly reliable and consistent from box to box. He avoided defensive work a bit in his prime, but he was end-to-end and hardly missed a game. With Drogba, they were the core, the central five. They were a powerful presence in the dressing room. At no point before the game did I accept that Chelsea would be under more pressure than us, by virtue of Abramovich's Moscow background, though he was there in the stands, gazing down on his vast investment. I didn't see that as a factor in the game itself. Security was my main concern. Moscow is a city of great mysteries. I've read books on the Russian Revolution and on Stalin, who was worse than the Tsars, killing his own people to collectivise agriculture. We took two chefs with us, and the food was mostly fine, unlike in Rome, where it was a joke, a disgrace. What a season Ronaldo had in that European Cup-winning campaign. 42 goals for a winger. In some games, he played centre-forward, but he was essentially a wide man in our system. In every game, he would create three chances for himself. I watched him one night at Real Madrid, and he had about 40 shots on goal. Moscow was a relief, above all, because I always said Manchester United ought to be achieving more in Europe. It was our third European Cup victory and took us closer to Liverpool's five. I always felt we would match Liverpool's total within a reasonable stretch of time, even after the two defeats to Barcelona in 2009 and 2011, because we had earned extra respect in Europe. With a win in either of those Barcelona finals, we would have been on four, equal with Bayern Munich at the time, and with Ajax. In our moment of triumph, there was no champagne to be found at the Luzhniki Stadium. In the absence of the real stuff, staff were dispatched to a bar to buy some kind of fizzy liquid. Heaven knows what it was. "I can't even offer you a glass of champagne," I apologised to Andy Roxburgh, who came into our dressing room to congratulate us. Whatever was in those bottles, we shook it about and made a fuss. There was a lot of hilarity and nonsense with the players giving each other stick. You're pleased and proud of them. I was soaked to the skin from the rain and forced to change into my tracksuit. There was no sign of Abramovich, and I don't recall any Chelsea players coming in. The 1999 final in Barcelona, when we beat Bayern Munich, fell on the late Sir Matt Busby's birthday. Sometimes you hope the gods are with you, or that old Matt is looking down. I'm not a great believer in coincidences, but there is such a thing as fate, and I wondered whether it played a hand in both victories. Matt had taken our club into Europe when the English League was firmly set against it. He was shown to be right, because English football has had some glorious nights in Europe. With a major trophy in your possession, you should always buy players to refresh the squad and avoid the risk of stagnation. It was in the weeks after Moscow that we added Dimitar Berbatov to our squad. Berbatov had been on our target list before he moved to Spurs. He had talent in abundance, good balance, composure on the ball, and a fine scoring record. He was a good age, tall, athletic. I felt we needed a bit more composure in the last third of the field, the attacking third. But it ended up as a scrap with Daniel Levy, the Tottenham chairman, which left us reluctant to return to Spurs for players. This was our second trip on the Big Dipper following our move for Michael Carrick. You come off dizzy. You can't discuss both sides of the issue with Daniel. It's about him and Tottenham. Nothing more. Which is no bad thing from his club's perspective. 18. Psychology. First of all, you must tell them the truth. There is nothing wrong with presenting the hard facts to a player who has lost his form. And what I would say to anyone whose confidence was wavering is that we were Manchester United and we simply could not allow ourselves to drop to the level of other teams. Faced with the need to confront a player who had performed below our expectation, I might have said, "That was rubbish, that." But then I would follow it up with, "For a player of your ability." That was for picking them back up from the initial blow. Criticise, but balance it out with encouragement. "Why are you doing that? You're better than that." Endless praise sounds false. They see through it. A central component of the manager-player relationship is that you have to make them take responsibility for their own actions, their own mistakes, their performance level, and finally, the result. We were all in the results industry. Sometimes a scabby win would mean more to us than a 6-0 victory with a goal featuring 25 passes. The bottom line was always that Manchester United had to be victorious. That winning culture could be maintained only if I told a player what I thought about his performance in a climate of honesty. And yes, sometimes I would be forceful and aggressive. I would tell a player what the club demanded of them. I tell young managers now, don't seek confrontation. Don't look for it, because you can bet your life it will come your way. If you seek a clash, the player is placed in a counter-attacking role, which gives him an advantage. When the former Aberdeen, United and Scotland captain Martin Buchan went to manage Burnley, he punched the captain on the first Saturday. "That was a good start, Martin," I told him. He was a very principled guy, Martin Buchan. In his playing days, he moved to Oldham and was given a 40,000 signing on fee, which was a lot of money back then. Struggling for form, he handed the 40,000 back to the board. He couldn't bring himself to keep money he felt he had not earned. Imagine that happening today. In general, across my career, people always assumed I had elaborate Machiavellian strategies. In reality, I didn't set out to master the dark arts. I did try the odd trick. Saying we always finished the campaign at a higher gallop and with heightened resolve could be classified as a mind game. And I was intrigued to see Carlo Ancelotti, the Chelsea manager, twig it, in the winter of 2009. To paraphrase, he said, "Alex is saying United are stronger in the second half of the season. But we are too." I did it every year. "Wait till the second half of the season," I would say. And it always worked. It crept into the minds of our players and became a nagging fear for the opposition. Second half of the season, United would come like an invasion force, hellfire in their eyes. It became a self-fulfilling prophecy. Tapping my watch was another psychological ploy. I didn't keep track of the time in games. I kept a loose eye on it, but it was too hard to work out how long might be added for a stoppage to have an accurate sense of when the game should end. Here's the key. It was the effect it had on the other team, not ours, that counted. Seeing me tap my watch and gesticulate, the opposition would be spooked. They would immediately think another 10 minutes were going to be added. Everyone knew United had a knack of scoring late goals. Seeing me point to my timepiece, our opponents would feel they would have to defend against us through a spell of time that would feel, to them, like infinity. They would feel besieged. They knew we never gave up, and they knew we specialised in late drama. Clive Tilsley said it in his ITV commentary on the 1999 Champions League final, at the beginning of stoppage time. "United always score," which was comparable to Kenneth Wilsonholm in the 1966 World Cup final. That's a mind game. There is a psychological dimension also to handling individual players. With errant behaviour, it helps to look for a moment through their eyes. You were young once, so put yourself in their position. You do something wrong, you're waiting to be punished. "What's he going to say," you think? Or, "What's my dad going to say?" The aim is to make the biggest possible impact. What would have made the deepest imprint on me at that stage of life? A manager's advantage is that he knows the player wants to play. Fundamentally, they all want to be out there in the park. So when you deprive them of that pleasure, you're taking away their life. It becomes the ultimate tool. This is the greatest lever of power at your disposal. With the incident with Frank McGarvey at St Mirren, I was consistent in telling him, you're never going to play again. He believed that. For 3 weeks he believed it. He finished up begging me for another chance. In his mind was the idea that all the power was on my side. Freedom of contract wasn't a reality then. People talked non-stop about my mind games. Every time I made a public utterance, a swarm of analysts would look for the hidden meaning, when 98% of the time there was none. But psychological pressure has its place. Even superstitions, because everyone has one. A woman said to me at Haydock Races one day in 2010, I see you on the television, and you're so serious, yet here you're laughing and enjoying yourself. I told her, well, do you not want me to be serious at work? My job is about concentration. Everything that goes on in my brain has to be beneficial to the players. I cannot make mistakes. I don't take notes. I don't rely on video evidence. And I have to be right. It's a serious business. And I don't want to be making mistakes. I made plenty, of course. In a Champions League semi-final against Borussia Dortmund, I was convinced Peter Schmeichel had made an error. But at the time, I wasn't wearing my spectacles at games. Peter said, it took a deflection. Deflection, my arse, I shouted. No deflection! When I saw the replay later, I could see the ball had made a violent change in direction. So I started wearing my glasses to games. I couldn't afford to make mistakes like that, to embarrass myself. If you ask a defender, why did you try to play him offside? And his reply is, I didn't try to play him offside. You need to know you're correct in your assertion. It makes no sense to offer players an easy chance to tell themselves, the manager's lost it. If they lose faith in your knowledge, they lose faith in you. That grasp of the facts must be kept at a high level for all time. You have to be accurate in what you say to the players. Trying to be right could be fun too. It wasn't all a quest for the truth. A game we would play was trying to guess the opposition's starting 11. One night, I made my usual confident prediction about who would play. When the team came under the door for a Champions League game, Rennie announced, Boss, they made 6 changes. I froze, then saw my opportunity. Indignation would get me out of this hole. See this? I barked at the players. They're taking the piss out of us. They think they can come here with a reserve team. An early experience was playing Coventry in the FA Cup at Old Trafford, after we had knocked Man City out in the third round. The week before, I had been to watch Coventry play Sheffield Wednesday. You wouldn't believe how bad Coventry were. Archie Knox and I drove home without a care. Guess what? Coventry were brilliant against us at Old Trafford. Teams who came to our ground often became a different species. Different tactics, different motivation, everything. From those early lessons, I learned always to prepare in home games for the opposition's best team, best tactics, best performance, and make sure they were not in the game. The better teams would always come to Old Trafford looking to give us a fright, Arsenal especially. Chelsea, to an extent, and often Liverpool. City, when the Sheikh Mansour era started, would also arrive with noticeably enhanced ambition. Clubs managed by ex-Manchester United players would also be bold. Steve Bruce's Sunderland, for example, were not shy in our turf. My longevity rendered me immune in the end to the normal whispering and speculation that would envelop other managers after 3 defeats in a row. My success insulated me against the media calling for an execution. You saw that with other clubs, but not with me. That gave me strength in the dressing room. Those benefits transferred themselves to the players. The manager would not be leaving, so nor would the players. The coaches and the backroom staff would not be leaving, because the manager was staying. Stability, continuity, rare in the modern game. In a bad run, we didn't panic. We didn't like it. But we didn't panic. I like to think also that we were conscious of the spirit of the game. Johan Cruyff said to me one night back in the 1990s, you'll never win the European Cup. Why? You don't cheat and you don't buy referees, he said. I told him. Well, if that's to be my epitaph, I'll take it. A certain toughness is required in professional football, and I learned that early on. Take Dave Mackay. I played against him at 16 years old. At the time I was with Queen's Park and playing in the reserves. Dave was coming back from a broken toe, and he was turning out for the reserves at Hearts, who had a great team during those years. I was inside forward, and he was right half. I looked at him, with his big bull-like chest, stretching. The first ball came to me, and he was right through me, in a reserve game. I thought, I'm not going to take this. The next time we came together, I wired right into him. Dave looked at me coldly and said, do you want to last this game? You booted me there, I stammered. I tackled you, said Dave. If I boot you, you'll know all about it. I was terrified of him after that, and I wasn't afraid of anyone. He had this incredible aura about him. Fabulous player. I have the picture in my office of him grabbing Billy Bremner. I took a risk one day and asked him, cheekily, did you actually win that fight? I was there at Hampden Park when they picked the best Scottish team of all time, and Dave's name was absent. Everyone was embarrassed. I could criticise my team publicly, but I could never castigate an individual after the game to the media. The supporters were entitled to know when I was unhappy with a performance, but not an individual. It all went back to Jock Stein. I would question him all the time about everything. At Celtic, he was always so humble. It almost became annoying. When I was quizzing him about Jimmy Johnston or Bobby Murdoch, I'd expect him to take credit for his team selection or tactics, but Jock would just say, oh, wee Jimmy was in such great form today. He would never praise himself. I wanted him to announce just once, well, I decided to play 4-3-3 today and it worked. But he was just too humble to do it. Jock missed a Celtic trip to America after a car crash, and Sean Fallon had sent three players home for misbehaving. No, I wouldn't have done that. And I told Sean so, Jock told me when I pressed him to tell me how he would have dealt with it. When you do that, you make a lot of enemies, he said. But the supporters would understand, I argued. Forget the supporters, Jock said. Those players are mothers. Do you think any mother thinks their boy is bad? Their wives, their brothers, their father, their pals. You alienate them, he added. Resolve the dispute in the office. Sometimes ice works as well as fire. When Nanny was sent off in a game at Villa Park in 2010, I didn't say a word to him. I let him suffer. He kept looking at me for a crumb of comfort. I know he didn't try to do what he did. Asked about it on TV, I called it naive. I said he wasn't a malicious player, but it was a two-footed tackle and he had to go. Straightforward. There was no lasting damage. I merely said he had made a mistake in a tackle, as we all have, because it's an emotional game. People assumed I was always waging psychological war against Arsene Wenger, always trying to cause detonations in his brain. I don't think I set out to provoke him, but sometimes I did use mind games in the sense that I would plant small inferences, knowing that the press would see them as psychological forays. I remember Brian Little, who was then managing Aston Villa, calling me about a remark I had made before we played them.
What do you mean by that?
He asked. Nothing, I said. I was baffled.
I thought you were up to your mind games again,
Brian said. When he put the phone down, apparently Brian couldn't stop thinking, what is he up to? What was he trying to say? Though it served me well to be unnerving rival teams, quite often I unsettled opponents without even meaning to, or realising that I had. 19. Barcelona, 2009 to 2011. Small is beautiful. Barcelona were the best team ever to line up against my Manchester United sides. Easily the best. They brought the right mentality to the contest. We had midfield players in our country, Patrick Vieira, Roy Keane, Brian Robson, who were strong men, warriors, winners. At Barcelona, they had these wonderful mites, 5 feet 6 inches tall, with the courage of lions, to take the ball all the time and never allow themselves to be bullied. The accomplishments of Lionel Messi, Xavi and Andres Iniesta were amazing to me. The Barcelona side that beat us at Wembley in the 2011 Champions League final were superior to the team that conquered us in Rome 2 years earlier. The 2011 bunch were at the height of their powers and brought tremendous maturity to the job. In both instances,